Then some of the Pharisees and scribes came to Jesus from Jerusalem, saying, "Why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread." And he answered and said to them, "And why do you yourselves transgress the commandment of God for the sake of your tradition? For God said, 'Honor your father and mother,' and he who speaks evil of father or mother, let him be put to death. But you say, 'Whoever shall say to his father or mother, anything of mine that might be helped by, that might have been helped by, has been given to God. He is not to honor his father or his mother.' And thus you invalidated the word of God for the sake of your tradition. You hypocrites, rightly did Isaiah prophesy of you, saying, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far away from me. But in vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the precepts of men.'" Now the next part goes on and talks a little bit more about this interaction with the Pharisees, but I want to look at this particular piece to start with tonight, because I think not only does it help us give a little insight into the Jews and some of their thinking and how they're interacting, but it's a great place to put yourself and to make sure that we don't have the same problem that some of the Pharisees did. And here's what I mean by that. They had traditions. They liked their traditions. But you have to understand that a lot of their traditions were very well thought out. They'd been working on these traditions for a long time. Many of them had their roots in the Babylonian captivity. And so looking at, you know, at least 500-something years having gone by since they, you know, came out of that captivity by the time we get to Christ, you think, well, how did they reason through these? Now, I don't know about you, but my mama told me that before I sat down to the table to eat my dinner, I had to go wash my hands, right? So, anything wrong with washing your hands before you eat? Not a thing. So why are they upset here? The disciples, are they just getting on the disciples for eating with dirty hands? See, what you have to understand is they had some thinking that they'd done. Now, the Jewish thinking was often called Midrash. And if you look at some of the books like the Talmud and places like that, you can find these explanations. And there's a whole tract that has some information on this. And what they said, what they were deciding, was people want to be like priests. Here's kind of the logic. I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit, okay? The priests, when they went in to eat the consecrated food, what did they have to do? Wash, right? That's why if you even with the tent of meeting, there was a brass laver outside. And when they went to the temple and built the temple, it wasn't just a little laver. It was a huge thing. It was like a swimming pool size, you know, that they put water in with 12 oxen under it and everything. And that's where they washed. Now, since the priests had to do that, and we want to be like the priests, then to show respect for God and for his offerings that he gives us in our eating, we'll wash our hands. And see, in that act will tie us ceremonially and traditionally to the priests, even though we're not priests. Now, to tell you how specific they got about digging into this kind of stuff, they made a distinction between, okay, if you're going to be eating unconsecrated food, not food that's been sacrificed, it's part of a sacrificial meal, then it was okay to wash your hands under running water. But if you're going to be eating consecrated food, part of a sacrifice that you'd offered, you had to wash your hands immersed. You had to put them in water. They had that all worked out. How's that for logic and reasoning? If you grew up in that time, and you grew up listening to them explain this, I think you would have probably found it perfectly reasonable. Who wouldn't want to be like the priests, right? That was the reasoning and the thinking. What was the problem with it? Was that part of what was described for people to have to do under the old law? No. Now, did that mean that they couldn't think about it and do it as, oh, and let me tell you how the other detail they got. There was even, during Jesus' time, an argument between the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai of whether or not the washing was worth anything, whether it fulfilled their ritual, if the intent wasn't there. They even got down to intent. This wasn't just a physical thing they were doing. And one of them argued, Shammai, the conservative guy, right? It's like, if you didn't have the right thoughts in your mind when you washed your hands, noid and vol. That one came out wrong. That's mixing things up there. Void and null. There we go. Didn't work. Of course, Hillel's pretty liberal, and he goes, yeah, it's okay anyway. And a big discussion on that. So, were they also interested in how people thought about things? Sure they were. Now, why was it a problem? Well, Jesus said, you are so worried about trying to figure out this relationship to the priest and how this all fits and how to make people be holier in their lives and whatnot. Yet, what were they doing? He said, but you use your traditions to actually void parts of the law. You were so caught up in your traditions that you couldn't see that certain parts of it were absolutely against what the law said. And he quotes one of them here. And there were plenty of others that they had, but the one he picked was, honor your father and your mother. And so someone could come up and they could say, well, I'll use this same sort of reasoning process. And I'm thinking, which is better? To give my goods to God or to give them to my parents? Well, it must be better and more holy and more righteous to give them all to God, right? And so I'll just give all of my goods to God. Now, I'm not dead yet, so I'm going to hold them in holding, and I'll still be able to use them somewhat, but at my death, they're all going to God. And so, since they're all pre-committed to God, then if I need, you know, if my parents need something, then, well, we're just going to have to figure that out differently. Once again, you know, you can take things and you can just about make anything you want out of it, right? When you got your own intents about how you want to work on things. What Jesus was basically telling them was that when they start reasoning from the scriptures, they had to do it right. They had to do it right. Now, any of you encountered anyone in a religious group who has a different view on part of a topic of religion, be it baptism, be it the Lord's Supper, or be it whatever, that has a different idea about that? I think most people have. Do you think they're just wanting to make it up and just ignore what the Bible says? Sometimes I think we get that idea, is that people just are so pig-headed that they just can't read it and figure out what's there. No, in most cases, people have thought about it, or at least have had that presented to them in a way that seems logical, and they're having to work through it, and they come to a different conclusion. Now, it may not be the right one, but I think we have to understand that there was reasoning behind it, and we have to deal with it from that perspective, not just the, no, you guys don't understand anything. Now, let's get one part scarier. We have to be willing to look at everything we do in worship and in service to our God and in our lives and make sure we're not the ones who have created a tradition or something that isn't what the Bible tells us we need to do. You see how that fits to everybody? And this is what Jesus was trying to get across to these people. They thought these were the educated men of their time. These were the ones that people looked up to. These were the ones who were teaching people these reasoning processes. And Jesus had to come across again and say, you guys got it wrong. You're just not going after it right. Remember when we went through the Sermon on the Mount and the fence around the Torah there, the things that he was telling them how to do it right? That's a big part of what Jesus was doing, was trying to get them to look at the law properly. Now, his disciples, look over in verse 12, the disciples came to him in. Well, and we'll go ahead and read verse 10. He says, and after he had called the multitude to him, he said to them, hear and understand, not what enters into the mouth defiles the man, but what proceeds out of the mouth, this defiles the man. And then the disciples came and said to him, do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard that statement? But he answered and said, every plant which my heavenly Father did not plant shall be rooted up. Let them alone. They are blind guides of the blind. And if a blind man guides a blind man, both will fall into a pit. Now, again, in context, Jesus is teaching and reasoning. But what did he tell his disciples there about some of those Pharisees who got offended at this statement? Some people are going to be like that, right? And you know what? As much as we would love to save everybody in the world, one of the things that we have to understand is that different people have different reasoning, different things in their lives, and all of those kinds of things, and everybody is responsible for themselves when it comes down to their view before God. And a lot of times, we can't change it. What's our job? Our job is to teach, right? Live the truth and teach the truth. And to do it kindly. And these, Jesus is basically saying, they shouldn't have, sometimes that happens. And you know what? Unfortunately, if one of these leaders who is blind, they may be charismatic, they may be likable people, they may be quite popular, but all of those who would then follow a blind leader, what are they? They're blinded as well. And that's not a good recipe. That is not a good recipe. We've seen it a lot. You don't have to look very far in our own news to find people who get great followings over some silly things. And that's really the same thing he's talking about here. The blind following the blind. Now, Peter answered and said, and this is something we're going to see in a couple of different things here as we go through. Peter answered him and said to him, would you explain that, please? Can you explain that to us? I want you to think about it for a minute. He's interacting with his disciples here, but his disciples grew up in this environment, right? They're all Jewish. They've all gone to their schools that they had back then, in the synagogues primarily. They've been taught these traditions from their youth. They're probably at least in their early 30s at this point, because that's when they would have been considered to be men, the Jewish traditions. How many of you, when you were 30, got mostly a crowd of people over that here, not all, but how many of you, when you were 30, felt like, I know what's going on. I got my life together, right? Yeah, I mean, you know, this, well, at 20, you were really arrogant about it. At 30, you felt like you were, you know, okay, I've gotten over my arrogance now, not realizing it just gotten bigger, right? And then at my age, you know, pushing 60, you look back on it and go, oh my goodness, I didn't know squat back then. Life has this way of just kind of catching up with you over that. But now put yourself in these disciples' place. They have decided to follow Jesus. And he's teaching things like, your reasoning is messed up. All this stuff you've heard all of your life, a lot of it is good, because they had heard the Old Testament laws and they'd heard all the stories and they were familiar with this. But intermixed with that is a lot of this tradition. And so when Jesus comes down hard on some of the Pharisees, some of the disciples are over there looking and going, oh man, that's what I thought. What is this? I need to figure this out. Don't be afraid of being like that. Did Jesus get on to Peter for asking these kind of questions? What did he do when Peter asked him his question? He said, are you still lacking in understanding also? I don't think he was getting on to him there. He's going, oh man, I thought you'd get it by this point. But okay, here's the explanation. Do you not understand that everything that goes into the mouth passes into the stomach and is eliminated? But the things that proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and those defile the man. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, faultlessness, slanderers. These are the things which defile the man. But to eat with unwashed hands does not defile the man. So he goes back to the unwashed hands bit. They're trying to figure out, why shouldn't I be like the priest? What is wrong with this? And what Jesus is saying, how does this affect your life and how you live? How does it? Well, it's fine to say, I want to have empathy with the priest, but what's the real thing he's got to be doing? He says, out of the mouth and out of the heart come the things like evil thoughts and murders and adulteries and all of those kinds of things. That's what you need to be paying attention to, is how are you living? Let's get the priority straight and the reasoning straight here. And the Pharisees weren't doing it. So, they draw out into the region of Tyre and Sidon. This is now an area where the Jewish population is mixed with some Gentiles and some others. And Jesus goes there, and behold, a Canaanite woman comes out from that region, begins crying out, saying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed." Now, she's a Canaanite woman. What if you pick the two divisions that they had in the world, you've got Jews and who else? Gentiles. Who's this woman? She's a Gentile. Now, you think necessarily she, before in her life, ever believed in the one God and worshipped or served the God of Israel? No hint there that that's necessarily true. But what's she got? She's got a big problem. And she's got a daughter that's cruelly demon-possessed, and she doesn't know what to do. Oh, yeah. She knows enough that. And what has she heard? What has Jesus been doing that Matthew has recorded in this area? He's been going around performing these miracles. Now, mostly, and he says it here, he didn't answer his word, and his disciples came to him and kept asking him, saying, "Send her away. She's shouting after us." She's persistent. She's following along and saying, "Help me." And so he turns around and says to her, "But I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and began to bow down before him, saying, "Lord, help me." And he answered and said, "It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Now that sounds pretty cruel, doesn't it? "I'm going to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Anybody got a New King James? Would you read that verse in the New King James? Verse 27. Yeah. No, I'm sorry, that wrong one, whatever I said there. Yeah. 26, yeah. It's 26 and 27, read them together. Yeah. There's one big difference there. What's the word that he sticks in front of dogs there? Little dogs. The word, and I'm not a Greek person, so I'm not even going to talk about the Greek, but it's a diminutive form, okay? What do we call little dogs? Puppies. Oh, yeah, okay, my sister-in-law's got a little pretend dog. It's one of those Yorkie thingies about this big that's not a real dog. What did Jesus, I mean, if we were going to say it now, what would Jesus have said to her? "It's not right to take the crumbs from the children or the bread from the children and throw it to the puppies." Was he really putting her down? She responded in kind. She caught it really fast there. And she said, "But even the puppies get to eat the scraps from the table." What was she meaning by that? Yeah. You've got enough to go around. She's actually honoring Jesus in what she's saying here, isn't she? That he is so powerful that doing this one thing will not cost anybody anything. That's what she's really saying. She'll be glad with the leftovers, with the scraps. And so what does Jesus do? He heals her. He heals her. "Let it be done as you wish." And her daughter was healed at once. So here we have an interaction with a Gentile. Someone who may not necessarily have started out believing, but who had a problem, and in their difficulty, having heard there was this man who could work these wonders, went and begged him to help. A little bit later, we're going to see that the Pharisees come up under the same conditions, having heard this man who's worked all these wonders, and they ask him a question. "Show us a sign." I'm always amazed at the differences in the reactions of people sometimes. And I think we need to watch out for that ourselves as we're looking at things and how we react to what we hear and what we see and what we do. So, go ahead.
Yes.
But that demon was there. There wasn't somebody specifically coming and asking him to do it. This was a Gentile approaching him. Yeah. So it's not the first time he's interacted with Gentiles, no.
And the centurion.
And the centurion, yes. Okay. So he's had interaction with multiple Gentiles before. But this exchange kind of highlights this whole, how do others perceive this man in this way? How did that centurion perceive Christ? He knew he's a man of power. I tell people to come and go. They do what, you know, I tell them. The man that he threw the demons out of, what was his reaction after he was in his right mind? I'm going to follow you, right? So in each of these cases, we have people where even the Gentiles could see who Jesus was. I don't know. I hadn't thought about that. Yep, this is the first kind of woman that he's interacting with. Well, I don't know where the woman at the well falls in all of this, but that's because of the timelines and things. But, yeah, definitely. Could have been. You got a good point there, Drew, because it's a little scary when you look at it from that perspective, isn't it? It's a very scary perspective to look at. And you're right. Some of the Gentiles, I think, you know, it may have been more open and accepting. Now, were there a lot of the Jews that were open and accepting? Sure. You know, there were people who saw it. But it's not like everyone who saw the same things didn't come to the same conclusions. And I think that's what's kind of scary, too, because when you're reasoning with somebody from the Scriptures and you're looking at the same verses and seeing the same thing, and people come to different conclusions, part of what we have to do is make sure we've reasoned it out well, you know, that we're sure of what we're teaching and what we're looking at here, and that we're doing it the right way. Now, these next few verses, he goes from there, he goes up into a mountain, and the multitude's following him. Jesus is getting rock star status here, folks. But mostly is what? What are they doing when they come up? And they're following him now. They're bringing them lame, the crippled, the blind, the dumb, and many others, laid them down at his feet, and he healed them all. Why? Because he had compassion on them. So it gives us a little insight into Jesus. Why was he doing these miracles? Was it just to make people better? Was that the purpose of the miracles? Credentials. Credentials. That's a good way to say it. He was showing that he was the Son of God.
In verse 31, even though it's not a quotation, it sounds very much like an allusion to Isaiah 61.
Absolutely.
Where it's not, yes, credentials, but what's credentials for? It's showing that he is the Messiah.
Take a look at that list and compare it to the ones where Jesus, when the disciples from John came and said, you know, are you the one? What did he say? He kind of listed off the same set of things, right? You know, the blind see and the lame walk and all of these things. What were they? They were right out of the Old Testament prophecies as signs of the coming kingdom. And so it's letting people know a multitude of things here. The kinds of miracles that he's working were those things that were designed to show them that the kingdom was coming. The fact that he could work the miracles was designed to show that he had the power from God. And then what we saw earlier, remember, was when he had the lame man that came down and he healed him, he said something very profound there. What was it? Your sins are forgiven. What was he basically saying there? I am God. So that's what people are having to face here. Here's a man named Emmanuel. What does that mean? God with us. And he says, your sins are forgiven. I am God. And then he performs all of these miracles that are right out of the Old Testament prophecies of the coming of the kingdom. What is all of this adding up to, folks? Yeah, a lot of people said he was blaspheming. Now, all of the people look at it, and they come to different conclusions, right? But this is what Matthew is trying to get across. He's trying to show this conflict that's going on with people and how they're going to react to this and what are they going to think. And right now, he's got rock star status. All these people following him, they're healing, and he's healing them all. And it's he's done enough miracles that he can already check that box, right? So it's not like he needs to do more miracles. But then you get an insight into Christ when it says, and he had compassion on them. And he's still healing them. He's still doing them. And some people think, if you look at verse 31 there, it says, and they glorified the God of Israel. There's some commentators who think that that means that there could have been Gentiles even in this group here, this multitude. In fact, with the location where he is, might have been. But it's not a necessary inference. But we've already seen that he is kind of as a periphery, including some of the Gentiles occasionally. But his primary mission is still to the house of Israel. Okay. Feeding 4,000 next, and verse 33 to 39, he gets into that. And so twice now he's fed people. We don't want to go over that one. Greg covered that one with the 5,000 last time. We got 4,000 this time. And that's just the men, right? That's not the total number. So who knows exactly how many it is. But there's another interesting thing about it. When it says multitudes came, and then he's feeding this many people, now you get an idea of the size of the multitudes. And I happen to think, since Matthew was mathematically inclined as a tax collector, that that's why he puts some of the numbers in there, is so that he gives us an idea of what's going on. You ever been in a crowd of 4,000 or 5,000 people? Now, if you go to a football stadium, there's what? 40,000 or something in some of the stadiums. So, yeah, but even if you're in a crowd of a few hundred, it seems like a lot of people. But you get in a crowd of a few thousand, that's a good-sized group. Especially in this day and age, that's the size of a small city. In fact, it's bigger than a lot of their cities were. So these are people from a whole region coming out. And he's still working with them, and he feeds them again. Now, the one thing that I want to point out, this time they took up 7 large baskets full. They'd taken up food the previous time. I do have to occasionally throw in the odd story. Benjamin's not in here, right? Okay. When Benjamin was growing up, he was one of my children that didn't like fish all that much. I have to tell you, he kind of got that from me. I'm not a big fish person. I'll eat some, but not a lot. And so when my wife had fixed fish for dinner, and he didn't want to eat it, she reminded him that Jesus had fed the multitudes with loaves and fishes, and therefore it was a good thing to eat. And his response was, yeah, they took up 7 baskets of leftovers, so obviously somebody didn't like it. Why were there leftovers? What did it really mean? Not that the people didn't like it. What did it really mean? It was abundance. It was a lot more than what he had to start with. Another miracle demonstrating the abundance of the blessings that God gives. Joe, you had your hand up.
Luke didn't like fish either. My wife called it sea chicken.
Yeah. I'll tell you another story sometime about tuna salad that was made out of turkey, but that's a different issue too. So Jesus has now fed them again, and now the Pharisees and Sadducees come up, and what are they asking for in chapter 16? They want a sign, and he says, when it is evening, you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. In the morning, there will be a storm today, for the sky is red and threatening. Do you know how to discern the appearance of the sky, but cannot discern the signs of the times? An evil and adulterous generation asks for a sign, and the sign will not be given it except the sign of Jonah. And they left them and went away. Now, what do you think they were asking for? What did they want? He said they wanted a sign. That wouldn't be so hard. What is a sign, anyway? What does John mean when he says, show him a sign? It's a miracle, right? We need proof. I want you to prove this. Now, maybe they hadn't personally witnessed it. And maybe it was the benefit of the doubt to say, be like Thomas, you know, show me. And I'll believe it when I see it. But I don't think that's the case here, right? When these people said, show me the sign, had they heard about what Jesus was doing? Did they have firsthand witnesses they could talk to of a lot of these miracles and things going on? Absolutely. Absolutely.
These Pharisees are ridiculous for asking this. There's no indication of how much time has lapsed, but
yeah.
There's no way they wouldn't have known.
Yeah. Now, one of the previous ones when he was teaching in his own country, he said a prophet is not without honor in his own country, right? And the same thing there. He said, I didn't do many miracles around there. Jesus wasn't miracle factory on demand. You know, that wasn't his point. His point wasn't, oh, you want a miracle? Okay, pick from one of the three boxes and tell me what kind of miracle you want and I'll give it to you. That's not the way he was working. He was trying to convince the sincere people, right? And he was giving them plenty for the sincere people to look at. But you know what? People have this ability to explain away anything, right? I mean, I've seen it even when the non-miraculous, you know, something happens or somebody's responsible for something and they'll figure some way that it's not their fault or that, you know, the phase of the moon was interacting some way. And they'll have an explanation that bears no semblance to reality. Why do people do that? They don't want to believe. Or they don't want to take responsibility. Or they don't like the consequences that would happen if they were to believe. No. It wasn't in their nature at that point. And got to remember, when he says Pharisees here, he's really talking about the leaders of the Pharisees. The Pharisees, a lot of the people were Pharisees in terms of if you had asked them, like, you know, going down the street today and ask them, you know, what religion are you or what church do you belong to? And people would say something like Baptist or Methodist or whatever. A lot of people would have classed themselves as Pharisees. Who do we know that was a very famous Pharisee? Said, proud of it, I'm a Pharisee. Paul, right? So it wasn't necessarily evil to be a Pharisee. When Matthew is using that term, though, we have to understand what he's meaning. He's meaning those Pharisaical leaders who were so stuck on their traditions of the Pharisees that reality of Christ just didn't, you know, get past their conscience. And they were unwilling to move off of that. That's what he means when he's talking about these. And the other ones that he mentions quite often are the scribes. They were the lawyers, as we talked before. And occasionally you'll mention the Sadducees, which were a whole different group and really had no idea what to do with Jesus. Because he just broke everything that they thought of. Okay, so we got this in here, and they want a sign. They're not given a sign, and it's right in the middle of Matthew showing all of these signs. So how are people reacting to Jesus? Some are believing. Some are at least following. Others are just actively don't like this guy, don't want this guy. He's messing up, you know, my life, my thinking. I've talked to people before that you get to a point where it's almost illogical, where it looks like it just the next step should just be there. And I expect, and then you get something like, you know, I've made up my mind. And you can almost see the parentheses behind it. So don't confuse me with the facts. And unfortunately, you will run into people like that. And that's what Jesus was saying when he said, you got to leave them alone. Sometimes people will come around. You just never know. It's not like you can just write people off. But sometimes it's better not to push things. And that's what Jesus was doing here. Sorry, not going to give you a sign. Now, the disciples come to the other side, and they've forgotten to take some bread. And Jesus says, watch out and beware of the leavens of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. This is another example, I think, of where the disciples were having a hard time with Jesus as well. They'd made a mistake. They're on a journey, and one of them thought, oh, Peter, I thought he had the bread. No, Simon's supposed to get it. No, you know, oh, man, we don't have our lunch. And Jesus says, you beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. And they're thinking, he knows we forgot our lunch. That's really what he's saying. Jesus kind of shakes his head at him and he says, they begin to discuss it, saying, it's because we took no bread. And Jesus became aware of this and he says, you men of little faith, why do you discuss among yourselves to that you have no bread? Do you not understand or remember the 5 loaves and the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up? Or the 7 loaves and the 4,000 and how many baskets you took up? How is it that you don't understand that I did not speak to you concerning bread? What's the point there? Exactly. It says, folks, we've been through this a couple of times. When there wasn't enough food, and what happened? Jesus provided. And that's the other lesson there with those. He wasn't just feeding people. He was providing. God provides for us. But he had a spiritual lesson he wanted them to learn. And the disciples were having a hard time making this transition to understanding that a lot of times when Jesus said something, they had to look past the words. They had to look to the implications. They had to look to the spiritual side and think, Why did Jesus teach in parables? Why did he say he taught in parables? Some people would understand, and how about other people? So that they would not understand. When you tell a story that's related to something you're studying or whatever, and I tried deliberately to tell some stories sometimes. You know why? Because a lot of you will forget everything else I say, but you might remember the story, and then we'll get to connect to where it went. But when you're looking through this, and you put yourselves in their place again, how does leaven match up with this? What's leaven? Now, we think of it as yeast. For them, it's more like sourdough. Okay? How do you make a loaf of sourdough bread? Most of the guys have no idea, right? You go buy it from the store. HEB makes great sourdough bread. You got a sourdough starter, right? You got to have your starter. And the taste of your sourdough bread is going to be dependent on your starter. And then you mix up a batch of your flour and everything. You put it in it. And then and you got non-sourdough. How do you make it turn into sourdough? Well, you take a piece of the starter and you put it in there, right? But now you've used up some of your starter. How do you keep your starter going? You have to feed it, right? Okay, so you put some non-flour in there. And everything works out. You got sourdough bread. How much does it take of the starter to make the whole loaf sourdough bread? Not much. Not much. How much of the wisdom of the Pharisees did it take to get people confused and thinking that maybe Jesus wasn't the Messiah and thinking maybe they shouldn't follow this man? See, that's what he's really saying, right? Now, I want you to think of it from another perspective. Was he expecting his disciples to reason and to think? Absolutely. Folks, I'm really sorry, but Jesus didn't give us a religion. God didn't give us a religion that we can just pull out the sheet, follow rote, and we're done. You're going to have to think. You're going to have to learn the principles. You're going to have to learn how it affects you every day of your life as you're living, and how you make decisions based on those principles. And it's not always easy. But that's what he expects you to do. And that's what he was expecting his disciples. So when they got into this discussion about the bread, I can just see Jesus going, okay, guys, think about this. Did he just tell them the answer right away? First, he led them down the path, didn't he? And he let them see it. And they worked it out. They had to think. And it wasn't easy for the disciples. I don't want to be putting them down in that respect. If I'd have been there, I'd have probably been worse confused than they were. Then the next section, who do people say that the Son of Man is? Jesus is starting to get serious about the amount of time he's got left here on earth. And he wants us to make sure his disciples really understand things. Now, one of the names that gets brought up is interesting. Who are the people that they said he thought he might be? Who are people thinking that he might be? John the Baptist, okay, John's dead by this point. Might have been him coming back. Who else? Elijah. Why is Elijah important here? Forerunner of Christ, talking about in Malachi. We've got to understand also, Elijah was held in very special regard, still is. Do you know that in the circumcision ceremony that they go through, there's an empty chair that's placed nearby, and it's the chair of Elijah. Elijah is the Jewish equivalent of the patron saint of children. Why? He raised the widow's son from the dead. Okay? And so there was great respect for Elijah. And they knew that Elijah was supposed to come to help prepare the way. They're looking for Elijah. In the Passover Seder today, at the end of it, there is an empty cup that's left on the table and the door is opened for Elijah. Because they expect him to come back as the pre-runner of this is going. And so it was not unusual that some of these people would be looking at Christ with all the miracles and all the things that are going on and saying, it's Elijah. But now Jesus has already said, those people kind of missed it, right? Who was the Elijah? John the Baptist. Elijah had come. And he'll see that again in a minute. Elijah shows up a lot in Matthew. Take a look at it sometime. There are six very major pieces where Elijah shows up. including the transfiguration we get to in a minute. So, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God, is Peter's statement. Most people are familiar with that, a very powerful statement there, and his understanding that Jesus was this one who was going to change everything. But look at verse... Oh, go ahead. Oh, no, no, no. But at least he was at the right starting point. You know, and I look at Peter, and Peter gives me such great hope. Because we see later on, he didn't understand it all, and he learned a lot more, but his profound statement of faith here, even with what he didn't know, says that we can believe in God, and we can get started down this line, and if we learn more, that's great. But first things first. What's the first thing? Jesus is the Christ. That's where you start. Once you get past that one, you got a lot of learning to do, but get there first. It's kind of like in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, there's one verse that hangs everybody up, and you got to get past it, and you got to know it, and you got to understand it. What is it? Anybody know? In my book, it's Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, because there's a lot of people that's where they're stuck. They can't get past that one. This is the one that a lot of other people can't get past in the New Testament, that Jesus is the Christ. And that's what was sticking in the craw of a lot of those in the Jewish nation at that time, that they couldn't quite get past that. They wanted him. They were looking forward to it. It was part of their culture. But this wasn't one that they wanted. It didn't fit the mold that they were expecting. And so there's a lot of work that has to be done here. And his disciples now are onto it. From that time, real quickly, we're almost out of time and I didn't get nearly finished. But from that time, Jesus began to show to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised on the third day. There's an amazing formula there. We'll talk a little bit more about it next week. But this is the point where he's now start getting his disciples prepared for him to leave. He's still got a lot of work left. But they're going to need some time to get used to this idea that Jesus is now going to do something else that they didn't expect the Messiah to do. And what is that? Die. That's going to take some getting used to. And he'll work on that through the next few chapters. Okay. I think most people are familiar with the rest of it. There's the end line there that we also will map with Matthew 24 when we get there, and that is chapter 16, verse 28. He says, "Truly I say to you, there are some of those who are standing here who shall not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." And so there is the formal announcement to his disciples that the time is here. The time is ripe. The Old Testament prophecies have been carried out and they're going to be fulfilled. And Jesus is the one to do it. We'll start with chapter 17 next week.